Hi, everyone. This is Martin Willis of Podcast UFO, and welcome to episode number 12. Today's guest is Dr. Robert E. Farrell, and he has written a number of books and has great theory on UFO propulsion. Please listen to us on Stitcher on your smartphones. We have an app right on our website. That's for free. And please do rate us on iTunes if you get a chance. Your feedback is always welcome. And you can email us at info@podcastufo.com. Thank you, and I hope you enjoy today's show. Hi, everyone. I have Dr. Robert E. Farrell on Skype. How you doing, Dr. Farrell?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
Thanks for joining us, and let's talk quickly about, you have a new book that's out, and it's on the bestsellers list, right?
Well, actually, I have three books that made the bestseller list. The first two are novels, first one being Alien Log. The second one is Alien Log 2, The New World Order. And then the third book is nonfiction, and that's The Science Behind Alien Encounters, and that just came out this year.
I like the title of that. Actually, a lot, because I think science does not look at UFOs and not too hard anyway as of yet, and you have some amazing insight on how they propel themselves, which I guess is probably the number one question that comes up: how do they get here? If they're limited to light speed, how can they make a right angle turn at 2,000 miles an hour and stuff like that. Can you explain your theories on that?
Yeah. When I became a believer, which was so long ago I don't even remember, I've always believed that there had to be other life out there, just the vastness. And astronomers are beginning to believe that there may be more planets in our galaxy than there are stars. So certainly it makes sense. And I don't think I've ever heard anyone argue lately that there isn't other life out there. And given the range of life of stars, our star is kind of in the middle of its life, there's got to be stars with planets in the habitable zone that are perhaps a billion years or more older than us. Mm-hmm. So therefore, there's got to be intelligence out there that's way beyond us in their technology, and therefore would have craft that could be flying around and people report. So, okay, I accept the fact that there's life out there and probably they are visiting us. Then the question is, how can they do some of these things? And the 100G acceleration and right angle turns really led me to understand how they do that, because there's only one way they can do that, in my opinion. There's only one way they could accelerate at 100Gs without damage to the vehicle or the occupants, and that is they're using gravitational field propulsion. Because if you're using gravity field propulsion, whether it's a negative field or a positive field, you are simply free-falling into or away from that field. It's analogous to jumping out of a plane. If you were in an airplane flying over Jupiter or some large planet that has, let's say, 50 times the pull of gravity, mm-hmm. and you jump out of the plane, you're going to free-fall toward that planet, but you'll have no sensation of acceleration. Just as our astronauts float into space when they do a spacewalk, they are actually accelerating toward our planet at about 1G. If they were circling some other larger planet, it would be a higher G-force, but yet they're free-falling. So if you have the ability to create this field that you either fall into or fall away from, you just point the field in the direction you want to go, and you accelerate in that direction, but you don't even realize you're accelerating. And if you want to make a right-angle turn, you point the field at right angles, and you start free-falling in that direction. And I'm not claiming they make exactly right-angle turns. There's no evidence for that. But it's near right angle. It's certainly a sharper turn than we can imagine our airplanes or our pilots surviving. Right. So the fact is that there's only one way they can propel themselves that way, and that's with gravitational fields. And there's other evidence to support that. And I can talk about that right now if you'd like.
Yeah.
Or okay. Well, let's see. Other evidence that they are using gravitational fields. And more specifically, negative gravitational fields. I've given over 60 lectures on this subject, and one of the slides that I show is two shots, two photographs taken by the same photographer maybe a minute apart or maybe 10 seconds apart, I don't know. But it's a UFO over a field, and it's kicking up dust. You can see the dust being kicked up from the field. And underneath the craft, in a circular area, there's a zone that seems to be clear of the dust. Well, if you imagine that they are creating a negative gravitational field, it would be expelling anything in that zone. It's that negative field that's giving the lift to the craft, but it's also expelling everything underneath it, including air. So there's two photographs of that, and in both of them you can see this same event. So if you now say, okay, maybe they use negative fields, what other evidence is for that? Well, people who have UFOs fly over their head, low over their head, have often reported that they've had this feeling of being pressed down. Hmm. Well, because of the negative field. Another thing that supports that is there have been occasions where people have come upon a UFO or onto the area where a UFO had been seen hovering over a shallow body of water. And when they got there, the body of water was frozen. So how do they do that?
Really? Wow.
Yeah, well, if they have a negative field under the craft because they're hovering low over this body of water, I don't know, maybe a foot above the surface, all the air is being expelled underneath them, creating a low pressure region. And you know what happens to water when you lower the pressure, the water begins to evaporate very fast. It might even start boiling. But the evaporation process carries heat away from that body of water. That's the whole principle of evaporative cooling. Mm-hmm. Eventually, enough heat is taken away from that body of water that it freezes. So that's, again, evidence that they have a negative field. Another possibility for negative field would be the fact that they can travel thousands of miles an hour without creating a shockwave.
Right.
Now, we create shockwaves with our aircraft because the way we transmit the signal ahead of the plane to tell molecules to get out of the way is through a pressure wave, higher pressure. Mm-hmm. And that signal can only travel at the speed of sound, no faster. So if the airplane reaches the speed of sound, then it's not signaling an advanced notice that it's coming, and the air molecules crash up against the craft and create a shockwave. But if you had a way to forewarn these molecules that you're coming and give them enough time to get out of the way, a way to do this using something that is faster than the speed of sound, like a gravitational field. It's actually faster than, I'll talk about that later, but it's been measured at being faster than the speed of light. But at any rate, it's certainly fast enough that these molecules now have time to get out of the way, and you don't create a shock wave. And in fact, the airflow around the craft is what aerodynamicists would refer to as a pure rotational flow. And in other words, very low drag. So not only do they not create a shockwave, but they don't really have as much drag on them as our craft would have.
So if something has been measured, has this been peer-reviewed over the speed of light?
Well, that gets into another subject, and I'd like to reserve that if I could, as far as the faster than the speed of light.
Yeah.
If we want to discuss Eugene Podkletnov's research over in Finland, where he's actually producing gravitational fields, and he's the one that measured the speed of his negative pulse at 64C, 64 times the speed of light. And I can't say that's been peer-reviewed. He's published, and in fact, I think he's coming out with an article soon in regards to his research, but he's been doing this research for years. In fact, NASA and Boeing were interested in it, and my understanding was that NASA tried to duplicate his work, but because they weren't using superconductors of the appropriate size, they weren't able to get good results. Now, one of Podkletnov's specialties is material science. That's what he develops, is superconductors. So he's developed a way of creating a relatively large ceramic superconductor that's on the order of 4 inches in diameter, and it will withstand up to 30,000 RPM rotation speed. And that's critical in his mind to create significant amount of gravitational fields. But so he's the one that measured the 64C, and I've corresponded with him, and I asked him to describe how he measured that, and he did tell me, but he asked me not to elaborate because there was an article that was going to be coming out soon, and he didn't want to violate his his deal with the publisher.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain to the layperson out there how someone might possibly create gravitational fields?
Well, and I'm going to start with the theory, and the theory goes all the way back to Einstein when he created his general theory of relativity. He recognized that there was a interaction between electromagnetic fields, and which is light, and gravitational fields. And in fact, that allowed him to predict that a beam of light from a star, for instance, when it passes the rim of the sun, would be bent because of this interaction. And he even predicted that a star close to the rim would have its light bent by 1.75 arc seconds. And that was back in 1915, I think. And in 1919, Sir Arthur Eddington went on an expedition and during the solar eclipse and actually proved Einstein to be correct. So the theory says that there is this interaction between electromagnetic fields and gravitational fields. In 1934, Dr. Richard Tolman, who was a professor at Caltech, wrote a textbook, and it was called Relativity, Thermodynamics, and Cosmology. And in that book, he spent several pages deriving a relationship and showed that a beam of light, back then they didn't have lasers, so he called it a pencil of light, was actually twice as effective in creating a gravitational field as a particle of matter. Recently, in 2011, December of 2011, there was a paper published by Lewis Rancourt entitled The Effects of Light on Gravitational Attraction. And he did an experiment where he shot a laser beam, past a mass that was suspended in a controlled environment, and he was able to detect the fact that that laser light actually drew the mass toward it, so it had a gravitational field attached to it. So if you were going to create a gravitational field, you would look at how could you manipulate electromagnetic fields. And in fact, in my very first novel, Alien Log, my astrophysicist is talking to his boss, who happens to be a colonel, and they're involved in a project. And they're standing next to a broken UFO. And the colonel asks him, you know, how do they work? And Corey, the astrophysicist, is rubbing his hands over the surface of the craft. And he says, well, I think this is a superconducting material, and there's a high current flow through here, and then they're somehow manipulating a magnetic field up through there. And somehow create, he didn't know exactly, because I don't know exactly, but somehow creating a gravitational field. Now, there are other possible ways to do this, and one of them was presented, I think it was around 2007. Dr. Brezhevno and Dr. Sandu co-authored a paper that was presented at the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. And that happened to be a joint session with the American Society of Mechanical Engineers and the Society of Automotive Engineers, and also the Society of the American Society of Electrical Engineers. And it was dealing with propulsion. And they presented a paper that was peer-reviewed and talked about a method for creating a craft that could be propelled by a gravitational field. And what they proposed was that if you could take and build some sections made out of parallel plates that were reflective, and you could beam a very high, intense electromagnetic field through those plates, in other words, like a microwave, for instance. And as the beam bounced back and forth, as reflected back and forth between these plates, it would shed gravitons. Now, some people don't know what a graviton is, and in fact, people who study gravity aren't sure how gravity, you know, what makes gravity. Nobody really knows yet. The gravitons is just one theory, that there are gravitons that exchange force. So anyway, if you believe gravitons is what creates gravitational fields, then as these photons are bouncing back and forth, they're shedding gravitons, creating a gravitational field. And so by assembling a number of these plates, and then staging when you turn the different ones on, you can kind of control the direction of the force in the direction that you travel with this craft. And that gets into another question, and that is, why do UFOs have different colors? People see them glowing this color and glowing that color or not glowing at all. Mm-hmm. And if you follow the theory I just described, as these photons are bouncing back and forth, shedding gravitons, they're losing energy. And eventually they get to the point where the inefficiency shows up as a radiation of photons from the surface of these plates. And it would be a whole spectrum, but it would depend a lot on the energy level that the craft is operating at. So, for instance, if the craft is hovering over the ground, not doing anything, just sitting there hovering, it would be running at a lower energy level, and the radiation might be in the form of infrared, although there are sporadically times when higher energy particles might be released, so you don't want to go up and touch one of these things when it's running, and you don't want to stand next to one very long, or you might die from radiation poisoning. But generally, it would be sitting there, and you wouldn't see it because it's in the infrared. But if it suddenly decides to take off and accelerate, then, of course, it requires a higher energy, and it would shed waste energy in a higher energy level and a higher level of the spectrum, more toward the visual. And the color might depend, again, on the energy level, and so would the intensity. So if they're accelerating, they might be very bright. If they're going very fast in the atmosphere where they have a resistance, they might be very bright. If, on the other hand, they're going slow, they wouldn't be quite as bright, and they might be a different color.
Now, what would you, if you had to guess what would, I mean, it seems like it would be electricity of some sort that would power something like this. What would be your guess on that?
Well, I have a bucket list of things that I want to research, and the energy source is on that list. So the only thing I might mention is a thing called zero-point energy that people discuss, and people are researching that. Eugene Podgletnov, in his research that he's been doing, and when he reports his results, one of the things that's kind of astounding, this pulse of this gravity pulse that he's able to produce out of this pulse generator has some very interesting things about it. That number one, it travels 64 times the speed of light. Number two, he's determined that its interaction with the surroundings requires more energy than the energy he puts into his device. So the question is, well, where's all that energy coming from? Now, he is an experimentalist and not a theorist, as he's especially his material science. So he doesn't know. I mean, he's perplexed, too. He suspects that possibly this gravitational wave is somehow causing subatomic particles to release energy. And this might be, i.e., zero-point energy. I don't know. But it might be that kind of energy source that's being used, because, you know, whatever they do, however fast they go or far they go, it's going to take energy. Where does it come from? And I don't know. And that's, like I said, in my bucket list.
Uh-huh. If UFOs have crashed in the past and they've been covered up as far as, like, the government, the military, reversing engineering them or attempting to, would you think they already have this information that Dr. Puck, I can't say his name.
Podgletnov, I know he's a Russian, but it's Podgletnov.
Yeah.
Podgletnov.
Yeah. Do you think they already have this information or something very close to it?
Well, I would be surprised if they don't. Number one, he's been approached by Boeing aircraft years ago, and by NASA, and as I said, NASA has already done some experiments, but because they didn't have the proper size equipment, or money, they abandoned the research. Maybe they pass it on to the DOD, I don't know. But the potential is so great that I would imagine that the military or DOD or somebody has knowledge about it. Now, you could hand the blueprints to a 747 to the Wright brothers. That doesn't mean they could build the 747. Mm-hmm. And there may be some technology that we haven't quite learned yet, like nanotechnology, that might be required to assemble some of the components that we just don't have that technology yet. And that might be one reason why maybe they haven't succeeded in creating a UFO. On the other hand, maybe they have. Some people think that a lot of the UFOs we see are actually our own craft.
Right, right. One thing you always hear a skeptic person say is, if they can travel so many, you know, light years to get here, then how could they possibly crash? Here on Earth? What do you say about that?
Well, I think there's maybe several reasons why they crash, but in general, if they are creating a gravitational field as a means of propulsion, and they're using electromagnetic fields as a means of producing that gravitational field, then a strong beam of electromagnetic energy could probably disrupt their propulsion system. Now, radar happens to be a candidate for that. And as a matter of fact, the military actually developed a weapon called the electromagnetic pulse beam weapon, which was designed to beam at aircraft and disable their electronics. So certainly something like that could do it. But a lot of the crashes have occurred in areas where a lot of research was being done in high-powered radar, at least in the past. My storyline in my novels is based on a crash in Kingman, Arizona that occurred in 1953. And they didn't have high-powered radar at that time in that area. They weren't doing research in it anyway. Because I thought, well, maybe they were developing radar for the Dew Line or something. But it turns out that didn't seem to be the case. Now, that crash I attribute to the craft being too close to an atomic explosion. Because I got to believe, when we started doing all these atomic tests out in Nevada, they had craft stationed there to monitor those tests. I mean, I would. They certainly would be curious about how we're doing in this and what kind of development we're making. And I have a scenario that I describe in the prologue of my second book. That UFO may have been there monitoring the nuclear test that was set off on 19th of May, 1953. It became known as Dirty Harry, by the way. But that craft got too close, was mortally wounded, but managed to make it over to the Kingman area before it crashed. Now, that's my hypothesis. So that's another reason they might crash. And sometimes they maybe crash because we shoot them down or something. I don't know.
Right. The theory here of the gravitational propulsion, does it matter how much the object weighs that is being propelled?
No.
So in theory, then, this could be something that could be used on an asteroid that's heading our way, possibly?
Well, one of the things Podkletnov suggested, now he certainly doesn't want his research and equipment to be used for military use, but he did say this beam that he can produce, which is it's a pulse, okay, it's a very short duration pulse, but strong enough he's actually been able to deflect a 2-inch thick metal plate through a distance of several kilometers, and it passes through buildings and so forth. But he was suggesting that perhaps a pulse beam like this could be aimed at a satellite to move it to a higher orbit, okay? Or maybe to disable it, I don't know. So it does have weapons possibilities, which he really doesn't want to have happen.
That's could be one of the reasons why there's been such a cover-up over the years, is because of the threat of national defense, that these things could be used against us.
Yeah.
One thing I talk about a lot in this show is one of the theories that people think that UFOs could possibly be interdimensional. What's your take on that?
Well, you have to understand, my mission is to try and convince lay people that UFOs and ETs are a reality. And these people are skeptical at best. They certainly would not go into a bookstore and buy a book on UFOs, which is why I opted to use the science fiction format. But in my lecture and in my books, I very carefully avoid wormholes, multi-dimensions, and things like that. I'm not saying they aren't true, because I couldn't prove whether they are or not, but I try to explain in a manner that's a nuts and bolts manner that anyone who's had high school physics or high school science could understand. And if I can explain all the phenomena that people see UFOs do using just traditional science, then they don't have to worry about interdimensional travel and things like that.
How about when people have said they've seen them appear and disappear?
Well, they're cloaking themselves, and I explain that in my lectures and in my book. And I, one possible way they could do that, just like the Klingons, of course, is they have a very strong magnetic field around them, and there's testimony to that, that they do have a very strong magnetic field. Well, there was some work done, actually a paper was published by Dr. Thomas Erber from the Illinois Institute of Technology. It was back in 1961, and he published it in the British Journal of Nature. So if any of your listeners want to research that, they have to go to the British version of the Journal of Nature. And his paper was called The Velocity of Light in a Magnetic Field. And this was back in 61. He was interested in seeing what the effect of a magnetic field had on the velocity of light. And he actually developed an empirical equation based on his studies. And the equations report the index of refraction as a function of the magnetic field strength. Now, index of refraction is the velocity of light in a vacuum divided by the velocity of light as it passes through a substance like a piece of glass or water or whatever. And, you know, glass has an index of refraction close to 2. So that means the light is only traveling half as fast as it does in a vacuum. Well, anyway, so if you plot this, you see that with a very strong magnetic field, you can create an index of refraction much greater than 2, or even a little less than 2, doesn't matter, but it's enough that you could imagine it's creating a lens. And this lens then is taking the light from behind the craft and bending it around so it comes out on the front side of the craft, and the person looking at the craft doesn't see the craft. It's gone. It's been cloaked.
I think I've read somewhere where the military is trying to perfect something like this.
Yeah, it's a little less sophisticated. They're using, I think, like miniature TV cameras, if you will, and screens on a suit, and maybe cameras on the back of the suit. And the cameras on the back of the suit are taking a look at what's behind the person and then projecting it onto the screens in front of the person, so you, who are looking at the person, don't see the person. It's like they disappear.
Wow, so it seems like there'd be so many angles to worry about and something
like that. Well, yeah, I mean, I probably simplified it a little bit, but I mean, that's the concept I think they're working on. By the way, the magnetic field required to do anything significant is very large, probably. Even to get a sufficient distortion equivalent to what you would see on a hot summer day from the heat rise off the road would require magnetic fields that are probably equal to or a little greater than our strongest fields that we've produced so far. But I'm not putting limits on the capabilities of UFOs to create a strong magnetic field. If they can do that, then they could use that. Now, there may be other means. I couldn't find any research done on the same thing as far as the effect of electric fields. You know, electric fields might also do the same thing. But certainly magnetic fields could be one possible way that they cloak themselves. So they cloak themselves in one location, move over to another location, and then reappear. Mm-hmm. Now, people say, oh, that's interdimensional travel. Well, I can't say it isn't, but I can explain it in a way that doesn't require interdimensional travel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One thing, in your books, you discuss the alternative to the Big Bang Theory.
And yes.
I really want to talk about that because that's always been a really tough one for me to swallow. I'm not a scientist, but what is your take on the Big Bang Theory?
I think the Big Bang Theory is wrong, and it's, to put it simply. Uh-huh. It's a misinterpretation of the data. It's interesting. Just last week, I gave, for the first time, a new lecture that I've developed. It's called How the Universe Began Without a Big Bang. And it's a two-hour lecture. It's PowerPoint. The first part is history of the astronomy and the astronomers and their machines that they use to gather data, going all the way back to Copernicus and up to present time. So I go through and talk a little bit about each of these astronomers and the equipment they used and the results that they got and the tools that they developed. And then the second part is talking about the Big Bang and as a way of interpreting all the data that's been accumulated. And then the third part is to talk about a better theory, in my opinion, that is much better than the Big Bang theory. It uses the same data but doesn't violate all of the fundamental laws of physics that the Big Bang theory violates, and I'd be glad to explain that theory if you'd like.
Yes, would you?
Okay. Well, if we start way back in around 1928, a gentleman by the name of Paul Dirac, he was a physicist, an English physicist, and Paul Dirac mathematically proved that particles should have antiparticles.
Right.
And so then in 1930, he proposed that the vacuum of space was actually a sea of electrons that were counteracted by a sea of holes because the charge of the universe had to be neutral. Later that was revised so that these holes were positive particles, and initially he thought maybe they were protons, but then the mass of the proton was too great to explain things, so it was worked out that there was a particle that, of equal mass to the electron, but opposite charge. And that led to the discovery of the positron, and it led to Dirac getting a Nobel Prize in 1933. So if you imagine then this concept of a sea of stuff, and that's the basis of this theory. By the way, I did not invent this theory. I subscribe wholeheartedly to it. And it turns out one of my friends here in Sun City West actually developed the theory, and I'm now his disciple, you might say. But anyway, so I was always trained to avoid singularities throughout my math courses and engineering courses. You know, whatever you do, avoid the singularity. And here the Big Bang starts off in a singularity. So that turned me off right off the bat. Another thing that is a clue that the Big Bang theory might be wrong is the interpretation of the data that they have, and this is the data is good. The data says that the further away a galactic cluster is from us, the faster it's traveling. And they, Big Bang theorists, are forced to interpret that as acceleration. And of course, if you have acceleration, you need a force to create that, and therefore you need energy to create the force, and therefore you need to go find dark energy. Well, guess what? They haven't found it, so that's certainly a clue that maybe they're on the wrong track. Hmm. So those are a couple things that make me believe that they're wrong. And Bobby McGeehee is the one who developed this theory, and I hope someday he gets some kind of an award for it. If you start off with the idea that it's much easier to imagine that the universe began with all the matter in place on day one in a different form. Mm-hmm. And that form is such that that matter can be created, can be converted into energy, because to create the universe required a lot of energy, the universe as we see it, okay? And the most energetic thing we can think of is to have mass annihilation, because mm-hmm. when you have two, like an electron and a positron come together, you annihilate the total mass and create photons in the form of gamma rays. So Bobby imagines that the primordial universe, which extends out to infinity, is a three-dimensional matrix, if you would, or lattice work, and at the lattice points are positronium atoms. Now positronium exists, they've been detected, and what they are is they're a very simple atom. It's an electron orbiting a common center with a positron. And they both have the same mass, so the center is in between. And they're spinning fast enough that the centrifugal force keeps them away, and there's also electric charges and electrical forces that counterbalance. And so they are in this matrix locked in with all these gazillion other positroniums in a stable arrangement. The primordial universe is at absolute zero or near absolute zero, and it's a very stable system, because normally positroniums are not stable. They tend to annihilate each other in just a fraction of a second and become photons. So in our laboratory, they're not very stable, but he visualizes that perhaps in the primordial universe, it would be a stable structure. So if you go back about 24 to 30 billion years ago, in his estimate, you could say the finger of God disrupted one of these positroniums, and it annihilated, releasing two gamma rays, which in turn hit two other positroniums, releasing four gamma rays, and so on. So you can imagine you now have a chain reaction that's occurring. Mm-hmm. And this explosion, if you want to call it that, is expanding at the speed of light, or near the speed of light. And he calls it a deflagration wave. So within this wave, it's expanding outward at near the speed of light. There are various stages of events that are occurring throughout the thickness of this deflagration wave. And he estimates the thickness to be 2.5 billion light years. So a lot can happen within that time frame. But on the outer front of this deflagration wave, of course, photons in the form of gamma rays are being shot out and causing the chain reaction to continue. Behind the wave, eventually the photons are converted back into particles, subatomic particles, and then eventually atoms, and then eventually molecules, and then eventually particles that agglomerate and form heavier particles. Now, these particles are traveling at near light speed, so they are gravitationally enhanced, according to relativity, which causes the attraction to be even greater between these particles and causes them to agglomerate faster. Eventually, you get dust and gas that's formed, mostly hydrogen, some helium, and there are pockets where gravity is a little stronger than others, so the dust and gas begin to collapse and form stars. And eventually, out of those, galaxies form and clusters form. So that's all occurring on this side of that deflagration wave. It's speeding onward even as we speak. It's way out there going on, doing its thing. But what's happening inside and behind on our side of this wave, because of the mixing that's occurring, when these particles collide, they may collide off-center and they start spinning. And of course, you know, you've seen pictures of galaxies that are spinning, and a lot of things are spinning. What's happening is the linear momentum that's originally at the wavefront of these initial particles that are being created is being converted to angular momentum. What that means is the linear momentum is decreasing as the angular momentum goes up. Therefore, the velocity in a linear direction is decreasing. So the closer into us that we look at things, the slower they're moving. And wouldn't you know, that's exactly what the data says. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A good analogy that Bobby gives in that respect. First of all, as far as the deflagration wave, is if you had a room filled with methane and air, and of course you don't want to be in that room, you're standing outside and you're looking through this thick glass window with a camera, a high-speed camera, and you set off a spark in the middle of the room, you can imagine what that high-speed film camera will show you. It'll be like an explosion. And expanding outward is this bubble that's growing, and it's very bright because it's radiating energy that's continuing the explosion process. And what's really happening is the molecules that were methane and oxygen and nitrogen are being converted into a different form, like carbon, soot, and whatever, behind that deflagration wave. And are being left behind. There's a lot of turbulence in the wake of this. So that's kind of how the universe grew. But keep in mind that the total mass of the room doesn't change. It's just converted from one form to another. And the same thing is with the universe. The total mass of the universe was already determined by this matrix that extends out to infinity. So all that happens during this deflagration wave is a conversion from one form of matter into another. The one other analogy that he gives, because it's so good that I have to give it. Imagine you're standing on a corner, okay, and a potato truck drives by. Now, when was the last time you had a potato truck drive by? Anyway, he picked a potato truck. And it drives by, and you notice potatoes are falling off the back of the truck. And it's speeding on down the road 30 miles an hour, and it's dropping potatoes as it goes. So you happen to have a radar gun in your pocket. You know, you always carry one of those, and you whip it out, and you take some data. You look at the potatoes just up the road a little ways and record the speed versus distance, and then you keep recording data, and finally you get to the ones that are just falling off the truck, and you write that down, you know, 30 miles an hour, and they're six blocks away. And then you plot this data, okay? And you can, the data shows that the further out the potatoes are, the faster they're going. Now, you don't say these are potatoes. You just plot the data and you hand it to someone and you say, what do you think of that? Mm. And they're going to say, wow, whatever is happening there, it looks like it's accelerating. Mm-hmm. Well, you and I know it's not. It's decelerating as linear momentum is being transferred into angular momentum as potatoes start to tumble. Mm. So that's a good analogy.
Yes, very good. Well, we're just about out of time. A couple of quick questions. First of all, where can someone find your book?
They can find all of my books on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, or they can go to a bookstore and order them. They're all available as paper books or e-books, or they can go to my website, which is www.alienlog, that's one word, alienlog.com. And they can read about my books a little bit, and also there's a button they can push to find out where they can buy the books, and it links them right to Amazon if they click the Amazon button, mm-hmm. right to the place where the book is, or they can go to Barnes & Noble, or they can download an order form if they want an autographed copy and mail that to me, and I will sign the book and send it off to them.
Great. And do you have any future projects lined up?
Yes, I'm working on Alien Log 3. And the title is Alien Log 3, The Dulce Affair. And for people who are in the know as far as ufology, that conjures up some bad stuff. The Dulce Affair is based on stories about the Dulce base in Dulce, New Mexico, and supposedly an underground base right. where our military is working with ETs, bad ETs, to do bad things. And my characters get involved in that.
I saw a show on UFO Hunters about that. And when I spoke to Bill Burns, he told me that that was one of the freakiest situations that he had ever got involved in.
Yes. A lot of my research and a lot of my data, if you will, comes from a book called UFO Highways by Anthony Sanchez. And the first half of his book is an interview with Colonel X, who was there, but of course is remaining anonymous because he's got firsthand knowledge. And if he starts talking about it and they know who he is, he will somehow manage to die. That's where I'm getting a lot of my information. And, you know, I'm writing science fiction, so I'm not trying to take liberties because I pride myself in being very accurate in what I say, to the extent that the information that my characters give out is I give references in the back of these science fiction books, which is unusual. Mm-hmm. So by chapter, you can actually research what my characters said.
Before we go, just one more question comes to mind here, and that has to do with skeptics that constantly say, how could they possibly be visiting us here when the nearest star is 4.5 light years away? What's your theory on that?
Well, the key to that is the ability to accelerate at very high rates. And UFOs have been clocked with radar and other means of as accelerating at 100 Gs. That doesn't mean they're limited to that rate. But if we could build a craft that could accelerate at 100 Gs, you get to very high velocities very quickly. And relativity kicks in as you approach the speed of light. Betty and Barney Hill had abductors that supposedly, it was determined later, came from Zeta 1 and 2 reticuli, and that's a system that's about 40 light years away. Well, if you had this craft I described that could accelerate at 100 Gs, you would be there in less than 1 month, according to the calendar on your vehicle.
Now that's indeed, a constant acceleration of
constant 100 acceleration,
Gs.
100 Gs. Your calendar would say you got there in 1 month. And, of course, the unfortunate thing is if you turn around and come back to you 2 months later, the world would have sped ahead about 80 years, you know. So that's one of the problems. But that's one way. That's how you do time travel.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Well, thanks so much. This has been great talking to you today. And thanks for joining us. And this is Martin Willis with Dr. Robert Farrell. And that's it for today.